This is the Shopify Dropify, hosted by The Cut.
And I just got really frustrated with it and decided there's got to be a way you can get a bike up on a wall without physically lifting and juggling it. And that was basically how SteadyRate was born. Our web store is our B2C strategy, or it covers our B2C market. And it's a very important part of our sales strategy because it gives us a lot of consumer data that we don't get when we sell through a distributor or through a dealer network. Well, I think there's a number of things to consider. The first is customers may prefer to deal with the brand than a third-party reseller. They may just feel more comfortable about that.
This is episode 73 of the Shopify Dropify podcast, brought to you by the Shopify specialists at The Cut. Ben and Scott and their team are here to help businesses get into e-commerce, build new websites, and improve existing Shopify stores to grow customer engagement and conversions. In this episode, Ben talks to David Steadman, the Perth businessman behind the international success story that is SteadyRack. With a unique bicycle storage system, SteadyRack has sold hundreds of thousands of units across the planet. And David shares his stories from the very first idea to wholesale and direct to consumer strategies and plans for new product launches in the near future.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the Shopify Dropify. My name's Ben. Today we're speaking to David Steadman, who is the founder and CEO of SteadyRack. G'day David, thanks for joining us.
G'day Ben, pleasure.
Awesome to have you on board. SteadyRack's somewhat of a household name in Perth, particularly if you ride bikes. I ride mountain bikes myself, and you know my business partner Scott is a very, very keen road rider. Can you give us a quick introduction to yourself and, of course, to SteadyRack?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm an avid bike rider and surfer and outdoor guy, and I've been bike riding now for about 30 years and surfing for about 40 years, and I own and operate a couple of different businesses in Perth, one of which is SteadyRack, but I'm also a registered builder, and I've been involved in the construction industry for about 40 years as well.
I think probably a lot of people are aware of Steadman Homes and Signature Homes, but we're not here to talk about them today because they're not on Shopify. But I did not know you're a surfer. You're not working on some sort of surfboard rack as well, are you?
I actually am. We'll be releasing a range of water sports racks later this year.
There you go. There you go. I honestly did not know that, so that was a bit of a cheeky question that's put me in my place. Congratulations. Maybe we can have you back on to talk about Surfy Rack or Steady Rack for the water or whatever it's going to be called. But bringing it back, do you want to just give us, like, everyone a really quick idea of what Steady Rack is for those that don't know?
Well, Steady Rack is a vertical vertical storage solution for bikes. And the history briefly is that I couldn't get my car in my garage at home because whenever I pulled up to the garage, the kids' bikes and my wife's bikes were always in my parking bay. And that was fundamentally because they couldn't physically lift and juggle their bikes onto the hooks that we had on the wall, and I ended up having to do it. And I just got really frustrated with it. And decided there's got to be a way you can get a bike up on a wall without physically lifting and juggling it. And that was basically how SteadyRack was born.
It's brilliant, isn't it? I mean, we do a lot of interviews, and a lot of people come up with their product ideas from a pain point of their own or from seeing an immediate need that people have in the market. So that's a really interesting one because, of course, and people can go onto your site and check out the specific mechanics, but you can pretty much roll the front wheel of the bike up onto the rack, and then it's suspended and supported by the rack, and you can then swing it side by side to push it into the wall so it takes up less space. Is that about right?
That's a pretty good summary of the design. I think the whole premise for the design of the rack was to make it life easy for people who wanted to put their bikes on the wall. And the other interesting thing was wall storage or vertical storage was the least utilized for storing bikes because it typically was the most difficult to use. And yet the vertical storage is a much more space efficient storage solution for bikes than floor storage.
Absolutely. Well, you're keeping your floor space more or less clear, aren't you?
And it's the most expensive component of any building as well. So the less you use, the more value you add.
It's a triple win, isn't it? And I think it's not only for the people that don't want to lift their bike up into some sort of storage. It's for dads like yourself who are getting extremely frustrated with the young blokes and girls who are leaving their bikes all over the place.
Well, and I think that's an interesting point because we view SteadyRack as a storage solution rather than a bike accessory. It happens to be a storage solution for bikes. And our intention is to develop other storage solutions for sporting goods, as I've already mentioned, with the water sport racks. And that opens up a whole new market potentially for us, which is the frustrated dad who may not even ride a bike, may own a bike but never use it. And I think if we've discovered anything, we've discovered there's a lot more people like me out there than I actually thought there were.
Completely. I mean, our garage is totally constantly giving me nightmares, and it's not even because of bikes. It's just because of all the stuff that's in there, kite boards, surfboards, bikes, the combination of everything and what your kids have and your wife has, it all gets pretty hard to manage. Now, just before we started recording, you said you were juggling about 30 things at once, but typically within SteadyRack, what are you doing day-to-day there, David?
Well, my primary focus is sales and growing the sales, but primarily sales and product development. Obviously, there's the strategic planning that needs to be done for the business, for the growth, to cater for the growth. I mean, since COVID, I suppose we've all had to devote our attention to just servicing the demand, which hasn't abated still to this day. So that's probably taken us away from some of our strategic stuff and innovation, but we're gradually getting on top of that, and we'll be able to. We're recruiting new staff, and we'll be able to. I'll be able to move more into the product development side of the business going forward.
Awesome. I was just about to ask. I would assume that the product development is what sort of that's really fun for you, and where the passion lies is. It is actually coming up with new ideas and refining existing ones.
I was actually asked for an awards competition once to do a little 30-second video with all the staff, and one of the questions was, what's the thing you like most about working for SteadyRack? And the universal answer was that it's a lot of fun. I think we have a lot of happy customers, and that makes business a lot more fun.
Completely.
And, yeah, it is the part of the strategic plan thinking and the innovation and new product development is something that I really enjoy.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
And moving myself away from the day-to-day execution of the sales strategies and the marketing strategies administration is fundamentally important. You know, we all need to devote a percentage of our time to innovation and keeping ahead of the game. And you can't do that if you're buried in the day-to-day out in the warehouse labelling products to ship out.
Not that very, very, very common problem, isn't it, to find the time in amongst the work to do the things that are going to benefit moving forward.
And it's a very important focus of ours with our senior team to ensure they have time to innovate.
Yeah, I can imagine. So just to give some context, I guess, before we move forward with the interview, SteadyRack is a manufacturer. So you're selling to the retailers, right, around the world, rather than at the moment the direct-to-consumer being a large part of the business, which I know is in your forward planning.
We have a mix of B2B and B2C.
Yeah.
And as you rightly point out, print. Primarily B2B. Our web store is our B2C strategy, or it covers our B2C market, and it's a very important part of our sales strategy because it gives us a lot of consumer data that we don't get when we sell through a distributor or through a dealer network, because we don't get to meet their customers like we do when we sell on our web store. So yep. It's a really important part of our strategy, but it's not the only sales strategy for us.
No, understood. And we'll get to some more. We'll get into some more detail, particularly around aligning your products with your customers and understanding your customers later on. I've got some good questions about that. But if we can, before we go any further, like look at one big learner. Obviously, a lot of people who listen to this are e-commerce online business owners, or they're thinking about launching something, or they're in the early stages. If you could share one biggest e-commerce business learning that you think would be really valuable to pretty much everyone who might be in a similar seat to you or planning to be in the future, I should say, what would that be?
Look, I think we're probably going to have a slightly different slant on this to someone who's setting up a purely retail operation.
Completely.
But I think I think the biggest learning thing curve for us was when we started, when we first started putting product into the marketplace, which is probably in early 2010, I think it's fair to say that e-commerce wasn't really a preferred choice of most consumers. I think there was a lot of mistrust in terms of, you know, giving up your personal information online.
Completely.
And that situation has completely turned on its head, and now people are much more confident. I think for us, the biggest learning curve was when we started selling our product into the market was predominantly distribution. So we had distribution partners contacting us and saying, we'd like to sell your product, and we were very grateful for people being interested, really. So we were signing distributors. They were selling to customers who were then selling the products online. So we had a situation where we had a customer in a dealer in the UK who was very good at digital marketing and was selling our products internationally at discounted prices, and it was causing us a lot of problems in other countries.
Right.
So one of the biggest learning curves was understanding the global nature of e-commerce and how we could best manage that with our distribution network to protect the territorial rights that we'd given people, and how we had to unwind some of the agreements or adjust some of the agreements we had to control how people used e-commerce to sell our products globally. So not so much our own web store in that context, but certainly in terms of managing a global sales strategy, e-commerce has been an absolute game changer, and managing and having to being able to manage that, protect your brand, protect your profit margins, all of those kind of things come into play, and you have to consider that.
Yeah, the whole territorial nature of it is completely different to anything pre-e-commerce.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a really, really, really interesting one. I would have thought around 2010 was probably about the time that people were starting to lose that mistrust and start to come over more and more and more.
Yeah, it was probably
on the cusp of it, I would have thought.
Yeah, we were building. Yeah, we were. I think that's fair to say, and I don't think anybody really appreciated the power of it, particularly when you're talking about a global market and the influence it can have. You know, you don't want a retailer in the UK selling discounted product in the US or in Australia, where you've got a network of important dealers that you've built up that you want to support. You know,
completely. And I guess a lot of that's around your agreements and the contracts you have with people, right?
Yeah, you have to make sure that in your agreements you have those controls, whilst at the same time recognising that there are, you know, legal limitations in terms of what you can do with, say, pricing, for example. You can't dictate pricing.
No, understood. Yeah, that's it's really, really interesting, and the international nature of it is certainly incredible. We're answering questions around that all the time from merchants of all sorts of sizes. So we're just in the process or have just put the craziest ever year behind us with 2020. I'm not sure if it was the craziest ever year for you. Maybe it wasn't, but I think it was for a lot of people. I mean, one of the big stories I heard throughout COVID and even early on was how crazy bicycle sales went as people were facing lockdown and wanting to sort of get out and enjoy themselves with their families. What was the effect like on bicycle storage for you guys?
Look, I think bicycle storage mirrored the growth in bicycle sales.
I assumed it might have.
to put it bluntly. I think there was a period there through April through to July where we just could not keep up with demand and we were back ordered pretty much full time.
Yeah, which was the, you know, when all the bike shops were starting to sell out and there were no bikes to be had in a lot of cases, or at least your choice was extremely limited and in some stores still is now.
Well, I think, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, look, I think what happened was bicycle usage increased exponentially and it hasn't really slowed down that much. And so what I think a lot of where we probably are impacted differently or slightly different to the cycling retail or the bicycle sector was that a lot of people started dusting off their bikes and, you know, recreational equipment and suddenly and had more time on their hands, spent a lot more time online and started tidying up their garages and their storage. And so I think we had a bit of a double whammy. You know, our sales
grew. Had an exaggerated effect because it wasn't just new bikes you were storing, it was all the legacy ones that had been lying around unused for many years.
And still happening. And I think there's a lot of things that factored into that. And it's also important to understand the market changes so you can plan your sales and marketing strategies around that. You know, the use of the video conferencing, for example. And work from home has really changed recreation because people can, you know, they've got more freedom to, you know, do the recreational things in between their work. It's not like they're 9 to 5 anymore.
No, and they're not losing 45 an hour and a half in the car every day on the commute either. So that time is often being put into family and or exercise, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think all of those things impact.
I completely agree. So based on what we went through in 2020, what sort of ongoing changes, or you were talking about understanding the market and strategizing moving forward, what sort of ongoing changes are going to stick with us that were incepted or born or came from the whole COVID thing that we went through in 2020?
I think that's the $64,000 question to use.
David, I thought you were going to have an answer to this for me for sure.
Well, I can, I can try and use my crystal ball, Ben.
I just mean in terms of what are you expecting to carry through in 2021 that came out of change that happened in 2020?
Look, I think what 2020 did was accelerate our growth curve.
Yep.
So where we would have taken longer to achieve the growth that we have in a normal market, COVID has accelerated that. So what I guess that means is that we don't see it dropping back, but probably the growth that we've experienced this year won't be as significant. Although you do tend to get a snowball effect with this kind of thing, so I guess it depends where you are on that growth curve, and we're still very much on the up at the, you know, the bottom third of the curve in terms of the market potential for our products. So, look, I'm really excited for 21 and for the next 2 or 3 years. To be honest, I see significant growth continuing.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think, I don't know if you've heard the figure that what happened in e-commerce as a sector, but in North America, I think it was in the first 4 months of COVID, e-commerce as a sector grew 10 years worth.
Yeah, well, so, I'm a director of the Peak National Cycling Advocacy Organisation in Australia called We Ride.
I saw that on your email signature just before, actually.
Yeah, and because of COVID, and people's fear of public transport and, you know, lack of ability to drive, a lot of people have picked up other forms of mobility, particularly in short distances. So a lot of people riding bikes. And governments were forced to provide infrastructure for that. And you saw a lot of pop-up cycling lanes being introduced in cities so they could still move people around. A lot of those have stayed and become permanent, and I mean a hell of a lot. Yeah. And we believe, like, just in terms of cycling usage, it's brought forward the cause for advocacy of, you know, infrastructure to support that by decades, and that we don't see that dropping back either. And that's another factor. That's another factor in terms of the market for us and market analysing the market and where it's going. We see that continuing.
So that'll be in public spaces as well as, I mean, I've been in big corporate buildings in the city here in Perth and just seen rooms in the Undercroft car parks that are full and full of steady racks, like, you know, tens, dozens, I mean, even hundreds in some cases. That's the sort of thing you're talking about, having that end of trip and in public spaces as well, I guess?
Well, it's there's two things that influence people's use of bicycles. One is safety. You know, they need to feel safe when they're riding their bike to and from work. And I'm talking about commuting now. I'm not talking about recreational cycling.
Yeah, I understand that, yep.
And obviously security, you know, where they park their bikes, they need to make sure, you know, they need to know that it's going to be there when they go back.
Very much so.
So end-of-trip facilities address the security. The separating cycling from other road users and from people walking is fundamentally important to the cycling growth, and that's where these pop-up lanes have had a massive impact.
Yeah, completely. Getting them in and out safely and having, I guess, with more people, more cyclists cycling, those cycleways have to become bigger and wider and more controlled and better quality.
Well, and all of that leads to people needing more bike racks. I think, and one of the key design features of City Rack, of our product, is that it has, it is equally at home in a domestic environment for personal storage as it is in a commercial environment for bike parking, which makes it very unique, because there are no other products that we're aware of where you could that achieve the same outcome. So that opens a whole new market category for us.
Yeah, I mean, that's where they come into their own, in my opinion. When you see those, you know, the up and down racks and racks and racks of steady racks, where there's a row that's up and a row that's down, you've got a lot of bikes in a very, very small space. That's where the whole concept, in a lot of ways, comes into its own, where you sort of stand back and go, yeah, wow, you really see the potential of that type of storage then.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you know, and that's growing. I mean, vertical storage is, there's a little bit of user education required with our product. It's very innovative, and obviously it's patented, and we now have registered trademarks, which are all part of the brand protection and brand growth and brand development strategy long term.
Yeah, of course.
But the there is a bit of user education. We made them. It's probably the only really major innovation in bicycle parking in 100 years.
Yeah, it's an amazing concept, and not like any other either.
Yeah, yeah.
But nothing that a 30-second video can't cover off for someone.
Well, that's when you're getting into the storytelling, which is, you know, when you're marketing your product and you're selling your product and how you get your message out to the consumers or to the customers. Video is a really powerful tool, and that's where I think e-commerce comes into its own in that context. Yes, we have retailers who sell our product in store, but it's much, much harder to merchandise and demonstrate the product when you're in store than it is with e-commerce. And so our product does lend itself to e-commerce, and we have a lot of success with e-commerce. In fact, a lot of our customers, most of their sales are through their e-commerce divisions.
Yeah, they would be. I'd expect that, which is a nice segue into our next set of questions. I mean, I think, you know, we should have some disclosure here, David, that the Cut and Scott and our team have been working pretty closely with you and your guys on the past few months, not only on deploying Shopify for you guys, but also redesigning your front end site. I know there are some additional changes going to happen there over the next few months, but can you tell us sort of about the when, why, and how you first started selling online with a skew to reaching consumers? So when did that happen, and what did you go through with the site? You know, how rudimentary was it? Was it an afterthought or something you weren't taking seriously? Or just tell us a bit about that when you first started to try and get consumers buying from Steadyrack online.
Well, I think we always had the notion that we would have a website with a store.
Yeah.
And we set that up from the get-go. But I think our initial sales focus was on distribution, so selling through distribution. And I guess that was a timing issue because of the e-commerce situation. Now, at the time, it wasn't popular. And it's gradually evolved and moved and shifted more away from a total reliance on distribution to a mixture of both. And I guess we were aware of it from the beginning. We had it set up from the beginning. Did we believe it was going to be a major component of our sales long term? Yeah, probably not. But as the popularity of e-commerce has grown, we've shifted more and more. And now I would honestly say if it was feasible to do it, we would shift everything to our own e-commerce store.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. I think it's a common one that we see with manufacturers in all sorts of different areas. Now, like 5, 6, 7 years ago, they would have been, I imagine, very much like you, like the distribution network, those relationships, the protection of those was really important, and going out direct to consumer yourself was potentially seen as a pretty high-risk strategy, whereas in the last sort of 3 to 4 years, more and more manufacturers are going, well, I've got this channel here that's really accessible to me now. All the consumers are buying online like crazy people. It's no longer an issue to me now. I want to run a distribution network and my own direct-to-consumer strategy at the same time.
Well, I think when you cut out the middleman, your profitability is better. So that's
trying very, very hard to avoid using that term, David.
Well, I think everybody, you know, at the end of the day, we're all in business to make money.
Completely.
And I think that's always got to be your focus because if you don't make profit, you don't survive. But I think you definitely achieve a more profitable outcome when you go direct to consumer. The challenge pre e-commerce was, of course, that was physically impossible.
Of course, that's right.
You needed to partner with retailers. Nowadays, that's not so much the case. I think there are some other factors that influence how you manage that strategy because, for example, our product is bulky and heavy. So we can't ship our product cost-effectively globally from a central location.
Yep.
We need to ship bulk quantities to regional warehouses. Yep. And then ship from those warehouses to the consumer. That makes it a lot more complex an operation. We operate multi-currencies. That complicates the process further because you have to worry about there are other things that factor into the equation like currency exchange losses and those kind of things. So
absolutely.
You know, there are you have to take a holistic approach to the strategy. It suits us to be able to offer our customers the opportunity to walk into a retail outlet on a Saturday morning and grab a bike rack and go home and put it up.
Yep.
The convenience factor of that is important. Or to have the option to just, you know, at their leisure place an order online. And I think people are much more used to waiting for product to arrive now than in the past. Everyone's got used to the fact that if you buy stuff online, it's not going to turn up instantaneously. Although Amazon have built their whole story around
lightning fast fulfillment,
around the customer experience. They're totally about the customer experience. I think every business should be about that.
Of course,
and that makes it interesting when you're transacting with Amazon as well, which we do.
Yeah. Okay. So you've got the sort of the multi-channel / headless model happening for Steadyrack, which is very good to hear. If you were giving advice to your younger Steadyrack self back in the early days of selling online, in the context of what you know now, what your plans are now, what would you be saying?
Well, I think probably wouldn't have done much different to what we did back then. I think now, though, if I was like, we're going to launch a new range of products later this year or in 2021, we will probably take advantage of the significant database of customers that we've now built up.
Of course.
And we will probably release those products solely on our web store.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think one of the important things about business development and growth is, you know, we've been fortunate. We've got a very unique product which has revolutionized bicycle storage. And I can say that quite confidently. There's a lot of social proof to support that statement. We have overwhelmingly positive feedback, and we've sold, you know, nearly a half a million bike racks since we started, and we've had very, very few people return bike racks, certainly not from because of any defect. We may have people swap the racks because we've got four models now, but I think, you know, we've been able to build a brand off the back of that unique product.
Completely. You've got a very specific niche, which is often the foundation of you know, success and brand strength and, you know, simplicity in promise that then gives you a foundation from which you can build out with new offerings. And you guys are obviously in that position now.
So if I was if I'd learned anything, I would have said, I would say, if you're going to sell something that isn't innovative and unique, if you're going to sell, you know, like a new range of, I don't know, cups.
Yep.
Cups are cups are cups, the vessels that hold liquid. It's totally about your marketing strategy. Totally about your marketing strategy.
And it can be about the brand you create around it.
Well, the marketing, I think, helps you build that brand confidence. And then when you've got brand equity and brand trust, you can sell any kind of product. You know, think of the famous global brands like, you know, footwear brands like Adidas or brands like Virgin, you know.
Yeah.
They're a trusted brand. Richard Branson could probably, you know, apply that brand to just about any kind of business and it'd be successful now because
he's pretty much tried every sort of business, hasn't he? there's not much he hasn't dabbled in. And well, I'm not trying to be a smart aleck here, but he has tried some that have failed, hasn't he?
He has, and I think
the brand is still there, and the brand is still strong, and the brand is still trusted. But I mean, your point is completely right.
And now we're at Steadier as a brand. We're able now to introduce new products that may not be as clever as Steady Racks, as our bike racks, but we will get traction in the market because people trust the brand. So I think starting out with e-commerce, ideally you have a product that that is innovative and unique. And if you can't, if you don't have that, have a really, really good marketing strategy.
Yeah, completely. Completely agree. And if you were, you know, if you were talking specifically to other manufacturers who may not have taken the leap into direct-to-consumer yet, what's your view, what would your view be for them on the role of e-commerce and digital marketing based on your own experiences and where you're seeing Steadirack go in that realm in the future?
Well, that's a really good question. I think what our web store, we often, or in the early days, we got a bit of pushback from distributors and dealers because we were selling our product in competition with them.
Which is really, really common and something that I think, you know, still you hear now, manufacturers are a bit ticky-touchwood about that. They're a bit nervous about that side of it still. But then they're also like, well, you know, realistically, I've got to go down this direct-to-consumer path at some point.
Well, I think there's a number of things to consider. The first is, one of the things is customers may prefer to deal with the brand than a third-party reseller.
Yeah.
They may just feel more comfortable about that.
Yeah.
And you're giving them that option. But I think the biggest thing for us, the biggest factor that weighs in on us, and it's how I explain this to anyone that does raise the question, any dealers or distributors, one of the biggest issues for us is I think it's a brand protection strategy because if you align with a bunch of dealers and distributors and you start to lose, you can potentially lose control of your IP and how your brand is represented in the market. You can certainly be affected by margins. If you build too much, if you build too much dependence on a particular reseller, like for example Amazon, if you put all your eggs in one basket, you're vulnerable. And I think having a web store gives you that backup plan. And the other thing that the web store does, and I think I mentioned this earlier in the piece, is it gives us a lot of consumer data that we can't get from our distributor and dealer networks. For example, we know that the average number of racks purchased per transaction is 3.2. We wouldn't know that if we didn't have our own web store. And that's if you think about that, what does that tell us? Well, that means every consumer is buying 3.2 bike racks. We sell individual racks. So would we start doing bundles, for example? If we
It gives you a good steer on what you can expect on an upsell too. If someone is buying one or two, you know, well, the chances of me getting them up to two or three are pretty high.
Yeah. So I think plus it gives you a database that you can obviously potentially use to promote new products.
Oh, completely. The potential around that is huge and very well proven. And it's a community that you own. You're not dependent on Google or Facebook to control that group of people either. They're yours.
Exactly. So our situation is also a little unique in that we only have four SKUs, and the bike rack that you see on our website today is exactly the same bike rack you saw on it 10 years ago. It's still relevant. It's still design is still contemporary. It still functions exactly the same way. We've looked at a whole bunch of iterations and we've made minor improvements and tweaks to it over the years, but still only four SKUs covers the whole market for us. Yep. And when people buy them, we don't have an offer. It's not a fashion item. We're not selling into that database on a regular basis. So it is important for us to start now to introduce new products.
But also you have the opportunity to do things like, you know, tell a friend or drop a review and use those happy customers to bring you more happy customers, even if the originals are only purchasing once or twice from you.
Which is very important and which is exactly what we are doing.
So again, David, you've fed me the perfect segue because my next little section is titled "People and Products." So, obviously, when you're selling B2B and you're selling to your distributors and retailers, the customer data at what's probably still important is not something you're getting. So, how important will it be moving forward as you expand the D2C side of things to understand those customers and what really matters to them? Well, and
you're learning all the time.
Yeah.
And every product has its unique features and selling points, and some are more obvious than others. And it's a question of how you project those features to your audience and connect with that audience so that you engage enough for them to ultimately to buy your product.
And simplifying that education piece and making it really accessible for them to get that information and understand the product and then understand which one or which product variant is really right for their needs.
And we've got particular challenges around that. We get a lot of feedback. We're very active with our social advertising and marketing strategy as well as our organic strategy.
Yep.
And we get a lot of feedback from consumers on social, which is very useful and valuable in terms of how we tweak our messaging and how we, like, for example, in our new website, our bike racks are designed to suit the way you select the rack is you by the tire width of the tire on the front tire on your bike and the diameter of the wheel combined determine which rack is suitable. We've got four racks, but a lot of people, household people that are non-bike riders, don't even know how to read or know what the size of their front wheel is, and that can be a bit of a challenge. So you go on a website, you look at a product, it's fantastic, it looks like it works really well, and then you've got to choose the right rack and you don't know how to read the tire size of your bike. I will say, just to qualify, that same requirement applies to almost every other one of our competitors, which are fundamentally hooks. You still got to know a little bit about your front wheel if you're going to hang it up on a hook.
Yeah,
So it's not unique to us, but so, you know, in our new website, we've started to marry groups of bicycles to a particular rack. So, for example, instead of saying in our new store, it'll say designed for tires this wide and wheels this diameter, these bike types. So a road bike goes with a classic bike. We're trying to make it easier for our customer to select their rack. That's just one example.
Yeah, it's a funny example because I actually spent time with Scott a few weeks ago, like rewriting and restructuring that exact information and trying to lay it out really short and simple so that someone could scan it and get that hierarchical step-by-step understanding of what the right bike might be. And we were kind of trying to think of it from that point of view because some people will look at a bike and they'll just see a bike. Unless they're into bikes somewhat, they might not know any difference between a 27-inch mountain bike and a 29 or even a road bike or a gravel bike or all the different sorts of types. So, it's funny that you bring that up.
Well, it's a unique challenge for us. It's not like you're selling coffee. When you're selling coffee, you don't have to explain what it is. I think
it's really about getting the blend right for each person, isn't it, or the right beans so that when they get it home it tastes right for them. Because they're only going to send it back really if they've chosen the wrong rack and the bike doesn't fit in it.
Which does happen, and we just swap them out, no questions asked. I think the message, well, for us it's about, you know, if you're talking about being a manufacturer or even a retailer, if you've got just a few SKUs that deliver the kind of growth and sales and revenue that you're looking for, that's ideal. You know, from our perspective, we have four SKUs. They don't change. They're the same product, as I said, that we've had for 10 years. They're still relevant and current. We can manufacture, you know, tens of thousands of them, and we know we're always going to sell them. So we, from an inventory management perspective, that makes life much easier for any retailer. If you're constantly changing your products, you've got run out stock and you've got to balance your inventories and you've got to have the right number of each product, you know, it gets to be a lot more complicated.
Totally. You're in a very, very lucky and nice position there with that. Saying that, though, a lot of e-com businesses do have that small selection or that simplified selection because they are operating in a niche, which, again, can be really, really powerful to them. But, yeah, certainly the operational advantages you've got with four SKUs as opposed to 250 or 1,000 is pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is. There's no question. Conversely, that we have different challenges when it comes to getting the message out and connecting with the customers, like,
of course,
understanding which bike is the right bike for their rack, because there are so many different types of bikes.
Completely.
There's some groupings you can put, your collective groups you can put bikes into, like road bikes and mountain bikes. And we had a lot of people asking for a bigger rack for mountain bikes, because mountain bike tire widths and wheel diameters had changed dramatically in recent years. They've got bigger, and the tires have got bigger because there's no weight sacrifice anymore. So you can go to a bigger tire on a mountain bike. It's a much more comfortable and confident ride than a skinny tire. So we've developed the mountain bike rack. We called it the mountain bike rack because it fits mountain bikes. And that rack is now selling as many mountain bike racks now as we are a classic rack.
Wow.
And we firmly believe that's because people can easily make the connection. If they look at the website and they've got a mountain bike, they buy a mountain bike rack. It's a no-brainer.
And I think mountain biking is just a sector that's just growing and growing. Absolutely. And growing, isn't it? Like, particularly in the last few years. And I think, I ride a mountain bike, and I've never seen Kalamunda so busy as what it's became over COVID, and that has continued on. As you said before, a lot of those riders have stuck with it.
Yeah, and look, I think governments are investing more and more in tourism infrastructure for mountain biking all over the world.
Yeah.
And it is going to continue to grow. And it's a great, fun way to go out and get some exercise too.
As long as you're not breaking ribs or scapulars, right?
Did you have to bring that up, Ben?
I couldn't help myself, mate. But don't worry, I suffered the pain. It's not just you.
I'm 62 years old, and my wife and my friends are all telling me I need to grow up. And I keep saying, I don't think that's ever going to happen.
I reckon you stick with it, David, and I say good on you, mate, good on you. I might modify my approach slightly, especially when it comes to rain and wooden features, but I think I'm definitely planning to continue on.
I think a lot of these things, it's like a hangover, Ben. You wake up after a big night and you go, oh, I'm never going to drink again. And then within a few weeks, you're back on the horse. And And I think we're all guilty of that. And I was mountain biking on the weekend, and I was going downhill on some of the new dwelling up trails, and I got to the bottom of one run miles ahead of my fellow bike riders, and I actually stopped and said to myself, what were you thinking?
I think the hangover analogy is an excellent one. I have heard about the new trails at Dwelling Up, and they're on my list to visit.
It's amazing. Been
awesome speaking to you, mate. But just before we wrap up and I say a proper thank you, looking ahead for Steady Rack, and you're obviously shifting the business more and more entirely over to Shopify, what are you planning next, and where do you think the business focus will shift as you continue to grow, maybe through 2021 and into 2022?
Look, I think we want to capitalize on the brand building exercise that we've achieved. We view ourselves as a manufacturer of innovative storage solutions. So now we have a bike rack, which is carrying the business predominantly, but we want to start to release more products for storing principally sporting goods. So I think going forward, that's how we're planning to achieve more growth and more traction in the market. We'll be introducing new products under that Steady Rack brand. It's one of the reasons we've disassociated the brand from a particular product.
Type of product, Well, that's the ultimate growth strategy, isn't it? I think there's a lot to be said for staying in a certain pocket, like, you know, sporting or recreation storage, for want of a better term. Perhaps that's where Sir Richard went a bit wrong on the ones that didn't work. He went a bit too far outside of what Virgin was kind of known for. But, I think that sounds like an amazing strategy, and it's going to be exciting times to see where Steady Rack goes. As I say, it's probably borderline a household name here in Perth already, and that's on top of your home building brands, et cetera. One might ask, David, how the hell do you find time to ride bikes and ride surfboards, mate? It's a mystery to me.
I was talking to a friend who wants me to start to learn how to ride a foil.
Wow, they're amazing.
And I just said, mate, I haven't got time to do what I'm doing now, let alone learning how to ride a foil. I think I'll just stick to the surfing and the bike riding for now.
Yeah, the foiling's incredible. Funnily, someone told me just the other day how dangerous they are, because you got that blade, and he was saying these guys end up with their wetsuits and their bodies sort of chopped everywhere when the foil catches them at certain points, because you got like three or four sort of blades right under you effectively.
Yeah, it's really – I think it's – quite dangerous.
I think it is completely amazing videos. I love watching that content, but we're going to digress and we're probably losing people. David Steadman, thank you very, very much for joining us on the Shopify Dropify. It's been awesome chatting with you. Congratulations on the growth and the success of the brand. And I know me and myself and a lot of other people will be watching with great interest as to what sort of progressive storage solutions you're going to give us coming up in the next year or two.
You're very welcome, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. There's nothing we like better than sharing e-commerce success stories that are happening right now in Perth, Western Australia. Big thanks and congrats to David and his team at Steady Rack. Talk to Ben and Scott at The Cart for help with your online store. They are experts at Shopify design, builds, integrations, and international expansion. Please share this episode. And if you want a guest on this podcast yourself, contact The Cart at thecut.net.au.
Thanks for listening. Access e-commerce expertise from The Cut anytime. Visit thecut.net.au and connect on Facebook and LinkedIn.